You're listening to Central Time. I'm Ron Barrett. Now, you've seen the story before. A company, a business, makes a public statement defending the rights of a minority group or markets its products to that group in some way. Then it meets a backlash from part of conservative America, criticism from government officials, maybe even legislation, organized protests, boycotts, activism from local community groups. That could be a story about self-declared anti-woke protests in 2023, but our next guest says there's a long history of this kind of backlash, with huge similarities in the 1950s and 60s era of civil rights movements and desegregation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of today's boycotts targeting, say, Bud Light for marketing with a transgender influencer, or Target for inclusive clothing lines? Do you see the anti-woke movement as something new, or have you seen instances like this throughout your life? And do you have questions for our guest historian? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Lawrence Glickman is a professor of history and the Stephen and Evelyn Millman Professor of American Studies at Cornell University. His books include Free Enterprise, An American History, and Buying Power, A History of Consumer Activism in America. He wrote about backlash protests for Slate and is working on a new book about that topic. Larry, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to be here.
Now, this anti-woke movement, or before that, the anti-critical race theory label, may feel new, but you, in that piece, trace the history back to the response to the Brown versus Board of Education decision of 1954, the beginnings of desegregation. We'll get into some of the specific details, but big picture, what similarities do you see then and now?
Well, that's a really great question, and I think that the similarities are at many different levels. Many of the tactics, like you mentioned, boycotts, are the same, but also many of the frameworks for understanding what was going on, in particular, the idea of inversion, that is, that powerful people were losing their power, the idea that there was kind of a zero-sum equation in which movements for equality were taking power away from those with relative power in society. And most interestingly, from the point of view, I think, of modern conservatism, was the effort to use the state to tame corporations that they saw as promoting civil rights and taking away their own rights. I think a lot of times we think of modern conservatism as an anti-statist philosophy. And of course, that's part of what it is. But when you look at these previous campaigns, which resemble the current anti-woke movement, I think you find a willingness to use all kinds of tools to slow down the movement towards equality.
Let's start there with those government movements. Who was targeted and what kind of things did we see in heavily segregated states in reaction?
Well, at the level of one of the interesting things is that, as with today, one area of debate and one flashpoint had to do with the media, particularly the television networks. And we have to remember that television was relatively new in the 1950s. Television sort of came along coincident with the modern civil rights movement. And segregationists were really on the lookout for the fear that television was pushing an agenda that they didn't like. One of the things you find if you read segregationist newsletters put out by the White Citizens Councils, which was a group formed first in Mississippi shortly after the Brown versus Board decision in 1954, and then spread throughout the South, and then eventually throughout the country. But there were many, many articles about how television programs had an interracial cast, and therefore they should be boycotted. One of the key things that I wrote about in my Slate article was the concern that television networks were censoring the music of Stephen Foster, one of the most popular American songwriters of the 19th century. And what they were doing wasn't really censoring Stephen Foster, but they were maybe changing some of the lyrics that were considered offensive by the 1950s. And I was really surprised at the degree to which Congress took this up. Many local state governments took up the condemnation of television networks, which I think what they thought they were doing was just recognizing that words and lyrics that had maybe not seemed offensive to white people previously were now offensive, and that maybe it was okay to have Stephen Foster songs, but maybe taking out some of the most offensive lyrics from those songs and substituting them for other lyrics. So Congress, you know, there were many hearings about this at the state level, many investigations, many critiques of the networks, kind of similar to what we see in Florida with Ron DeSantis and Disney today, for example.
Talking to historian Lawrence Glickman from Cornell University, looking at corporations getting involved in social issues, backlash to that, similarities between the civil rights and desegregation era in the 1950s and 60s and what's going on now in 2023. You could join in with your thoughts on that, your observations, your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We also see in the era you write about, Lawrence, boycotts targeting companies like Philip Morris and the Ford Motor Company. What went into those?
These segregationist protests, some of them took place at the level of the state and government, as we've discussed, but a lot of them revolved around trying to organize mass movements against companies that they saw as promoting civil rights. So the Philip Morris Company, you know, one of America's biggest tobacco companies, gave donations to the Urban League, which was a civil rights organization. And the Ford Motor Company was not directly connected, but was linked in the minds of many people to the Ford Foundation. That foundation spun off from the Ford Motor Company, but it was founded with, you know, the profits of the Ford Motor Company by some of Henry Ford's descendants. And the Ford Motor Company supported, you know, various kind of social science studies that were kind of investigating the costs of racism. And they also promoted some community organizations that segregationists didn't like. And much as we see today with the boycotts of Bud Light and Target, they tried to organize boycotts of the products of those companies. They also organized boycotts of companies that sponsored the television programs that I spoke about before. If there was a television program with an interracial cast, they might organize a letter writing campaign against the sponsor and encourage people not to buy the products from that sponsor. So it's quite interesting because we often assume boycott is an inherently progressive tool, because at the same time as those boycotts were going on, we have the famous Montgomery bus boycott of 1955-56, which was one of the things that set off the modern civil rights movement. But what I wanted to show in my article is that conservative boycotts aren't new. They've been around for a while. And if you read the justification for those boycotts in the 1950s, you could change a few words, but the justifications are quite similar to today's conservative boycotts.
We also, another parallel you raise is then and now accusations that there's indoctrination of children going on by networks, by corporations, and by civil rights movements. Indoctrination, even the word brainwashing, I think had been recently invented at the time. What kind of things did we hear then?
Yes, there was a lot of concern that, for example, school textbooks might promote human equality. There was, I forget which city, but one of the cities, the mass transit system in that city, maybe Philadelphia, had a series of posters, which had, you know, to our mind, I think we would say very anodyne posters about brotherhood and sisterhood and equality. But the critics saw these as propaganda. And as you said, they frequently use the term brainwashing. They were very concerned about that their children were being educated to subvert their values. And so they talked about that a lot. Stephen Foster plays in here too, because some school districts in their, you know, they would have books, they would buy books of songs for their choruses to sing and so forth. And some of the textbook publishers had also agreed to sort of swap out some of the lyrics from Stephen Foster songs to remove, say, the N-word or the word darky or other words that were offensive and seen as promoting a racist worldview. And there were, you know, strong criticisms of those textbook publishers for sexism, I mean, for censorship and for, again, the idea that these publishers and school districts and municipalities were all engaged in this propaganda war, which, again, many white people saw this as a zero-sum thing in which these gains of equality were a loss for them. And that's how they viewed it. And they often use very strong language to suggest that they were losing this culture war, very much like we hear the very strong language today about losing culture wars.
And we'll pick up on that point in just a few moments. Lawrence Glickman is with us, history professor at Cornell University, looking at protests and boycotts targeting companies that are seen as taking stands on social issues and similarities between today's anti-woke movement and the backlash to civil rights and integration back in the 1950s and 60s. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see these similarities? Did you live through both eras? Do you have thoughts on what you saw then and now? Do you have questions for our guest about the backlash to the civil rights movement and desegregation? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Lawrence Glickman, professor of history at Cornell University. His books include Free Enterprise in American History and Buying Power, A History of Consumer Activism in America. He's with us for a look at the history of backlash to civil rights and to corporations that in some way supported it, how it connects to today's anti-woke politics, big in 2023. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Larry, before we go to our callers, I want to pick up on something that the strong language, I would say almost apocalyptic language that was used by some of the people opposing integration, civil rights groups, businesses that they perceived as supporting them. Can you spell that out a little more? What kind of things did we hear?
Yes, I think this is very characteristic of backlash rhetoric, which is that it tends to be apocalyptic. It tends to be, as I said before, zero sum. And I'll just give you one example that I talk about in the Slate piece, which is this is an opinion piece that appeared in the Citizens Council, that newspaper of segregationists in this case in Mississippi. And it said, this is about the whole issue of some television networks voluntarily not using some of the more offensive lyrics when they played Stephen Foster songs. And this opinion piece said, we have almost given professional leaders like the NAACP power almost equal to that of the early Egyptian kings. Today's Negro agitators are not only setting up their own monuments, but like the Egyptian monarchs, they are destroying the monuments of others and attempting to rewrite American culture retroactively. So this, you know, just strikes me as very, very strong language for what was, in a lot of ways, a relatively minor adjustment to the racial realities of the burgeoning civil rights movement. But you could find a lot of language like this in which there's a tone of grievance, a tone of victimization, and a slippery slope idea, which is that this is only the beginning of a process that is going to continually weaken the power that we have in society. That's the fear expressed by backlashers then and now.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Kay is with us in Madison. Kay, hello.
Hi, I'm a Civil War historian, and I think you've got to take the same kind of thing, including technology, back to before the Civil War. As John McArdle wrote in his book, technology, abolition rode the back of technology, mainly the railroads, national presses, the steamboat. Abolition rode it west. And there are also, for instance, the 10 rich Tappan brothers from New York. They funded anti-slavery societies all over the Midwest. It changed. And so once also, if you extended slavery into the Western territories, it became a plantation economic model, which would ruin the free farmer. So it came, as Henry Beecher said, the question is no longer whether the black man shall be free. It's whether the white man shall be free, too.
Okay, thanks for the call. And actually, looking back to pre-Civil War era, Larry, I got to say, reading your piece, I thought of some language, pro-slavery language from the South being very similar. If we take this small step, it's one short step to a destruction of our way of life, echoed in the 1950s and 60s and maybe today.
Absolutely. I mean, in my book on the history of backlash politics, I don't quite go back to the pre-Civil War period, but I start in the Reconstruction era when America briefly experimented with becoming an interracial democracy in the dozen years after the Civil War. And very much that rhetoric is very present. And I thought the point the caller made about markets and media mm-hmm. is very important. One of the things you find in the 1950s is that the Citizens Council movement, much as the conservative movement today, really felt it was important to set up alternative markets for goods they wanted to buy and also alternative media. The Citizens Council had radio programs, television programs, and so forth. And so they really did think that this was a battle they needed to fight on many fronts, and they saw themselves losing out in the general corporate world, which they thought was kind of going over towards the integrationist model that they were opposing.
Thanks for that call, Kay. We're talking to Larry Glickman, historian at Cornell University, about backlash politics, what happens when corporations get involved in social issues. And Larry, now we have, and you draw this parallel in your piece in Slate, a governor who declares a war on woke today in the United States. One of the governors in the time period you cover in the 50s and 60s declares an all-out war on integrationism. You mentioned people perceiving this as a battle, the war rhetoric that we see in both backlash episodes.
Very much. That's exactly right. I think that's kind of a piece with the apocalyptic language, the idea that this is a civilizational battle, that compromise can't be brooked because every compromise will become part of that slippery slope towards the loss of cultural power. It's very familiar to us today, but it really was very much part of the feeling of segregationists in the 1950s into the early 1960s as well. And you find war metaphors constantly in the rhetoric of the campaigns against integration.
Larry, the heart of our discussion here is this parallel, this backlash now and then back in the 50s and 60s. Is this a coincidental social response to different circumstances, or do you see this as one consistent political thread, an ongoing political movement in the United States that didn't really go away, has just taken different forms over time?
Yeah, that's such a great question, and it's one I'm wrestling with a lot in my book. And I guess the Weasley answer I would give, it's a little bit of both. I do think that that backlashes never go away entirely, but there are moments when they assume a certain kind of cultural power, and I think we're seeing that today. I think every movement is, as a historian, we really pay attention to difference over time as well as similarities. And every movement also is unique and different. And one interesting thing we're seeing today is that most of the boycott movements that I wrote about in my Slate piece were pretty ineffective. But today's the campaign against Bud Light seems, at least in the short run, to have been quite effective, to have really knocked Bud Light off its pedestal. And Anheuser-Busch, the parent company, seems to be really trying to regain the ground that it feels it has lost. So, you know, it's interesting to speculate about how the movement today is maybe succeeding with consumer campaigns, whereas in the past, they weren't always successful. They were, you know, very noisy at the beginning, got a lot of attention, but generally flamed out pretty quickly.
Larry, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
That's Lawrence Glickman, professor of history at Cornell University. His piece on the historical background behind today's what's called anti-woke politics. We've got that linked at WPR.org/Central Time. Larry's the author of the book Buying Power, A History of Consumer Activism in America, working on a book on some of these backlash issues we've been talking about. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, an internet watchdog program found social media networks at the center of child exploitation around the world. Find out what's going on and what it could take to change things. Plus, it's this week's edition of Food Friday with recipes and advice for delicious non-alcoholic drinks. We'll explore the cutting edge of modern mocktails, and we're hoping to hear from you in that conversation. Now, I like mocktails every now and then. I want something tasty. I don't necessarily want alcohol as part of it. So I've gotten pretty creative with some stuff. Maybe I'll share some of that tomorrow. Want to know if you turn to non-alcoholic cocktails, mocktails, whatever you want to call them. Let us know about it. Email your favorites, maybe even a recipe, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Then join the conversation tomorrow on Central Time. First, Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse was released in theaters last month to critical acclaim and success at the box office. It featured a unique mixture of 2D and 3D elements. It's a departure from the Disney Pixar style we've seen dominate animation over the last two decades. More blockbuster movies like Puss in Boots, The Last Wish, and the upcoming Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie are following a similar path. How does this new style build on animation of the past? How have artists innovated the medium up until now? Our next guest is a Wisconsin expert on animation history, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite animated movie or TV show? What makes it special or memorable? What animated movie or movie with animation elements blew your mind when it first came out? Is there a style you prefer? Do you like to watch animation from outside the U.S., like, say, Japanese animation? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies is an associate professor and director of film studies at UW-Milwaukee. Jocelyn, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob. I always love to be on.
Good to have you back. Now, we've had animation pretty much for as long as we've had movies, right?
That's definitely true. As a matter of fact, it's kind of hard to separate animation from live action. They're both sort of based on the same principle, right? Which is that there's 24 frames per second. With animation, those frames are just drawn or sometimes, you know, performed by stop motion. But yeah, basically since the beginning of film, we have the emergence of animation as a form as early as the very, very early years of the 20th century.
What were a couple, give us a taste of the couple of earliest types of animation we saw?
Sure. There's two that we generally point to as kind of like hallmarks of sort of first film, first animated films. It's always a bit like difficult to say with certainty what is the first. But generally speaking, historians agree that John Stuart Blackton's The Humorous Phases of Funny Faces from 1906 is the first animated film. When you see it, you can look it up on YouTube. It's pretty widely available. When you see it, it'll look almost like it's hand-drawn, but it's actually done with cutouts. So that's the first kind of animated film. But then Emile Cole's Phantasmagorie from 1908, which is really delightful, kind of like surrealist metamorphosis little film. That's really the first drawn animation, the first cartoon that we think of. And that is in 1908.
All right. One name tends to dominate, I think, what we think of when we think of animation. And one movie really set the stage for traditionally animated feature films. Here's a taste.
I hope, I hope, I hope,
It's Snow White. It's Disney. Can you talk about this as a milestone for better and for worse?
We cannot talk about animation without talking about Disney. And there's a way that I want us to kind of think about him today. And that's not necessarily as an artistic innovator, but as an absolutely incredible businessman. If I were to, you know, to categorize Walt Disney as one thing, it would be shrewd businessman, because he was very, very good at hiring the right people and occasionally getting people to, well, maybe kind of steal other people's work. So if we're thinking about something like Snow White, there's several really incredible technological developments that are present in that film. The first one is the multi-plane camera. And this is one of the most important developments for animation in general, especially if we're thinking about eventual transition over to digital animation and to 3D environments. The way that the multi-plane camera worked is that it was about a 15, 20 foot tall structure, this really tall structure, and it had multiple panes of glass, right, stacked on top of each other with a little bit of space in between. And each glass pane had a different piece of artwork that would constitute one of the different layers of an environment. And then the top pane, you could have the cell animation of the character moving. The camera would then shoot through the top of the top pane through all of these different layers. And that gives this really wonderful feeling of three-dimensionality in what is actually a 2D work. So the next time you look at Snow White, especially these sequences in the forest, you should notice how the layers kind of seem to move, and you get this kind of uncanny illusion of moving through deep space. That's achieved with the multi-plane camera. And the funny thing about the multi-plane camera is that even though William Garrity patents this in 1937 under the aegis of Walt Disney, something very, very similar was actually made in the 1920s by a German animator named Lottie Renninger. She made this really famous feature called The Adventures of Prince Ahmed in 1926. And she developed this, this object called the Tricktisch, or the trick table. And that was an early iteration of the multi-plane camera. But the thing is, she never patented it. So Walt Disney was able to take that one over.
Now, I want to talk about the labor that goes into something like a Disney-style feature film, or the other people who imitated or inspired by it. Could you just talk about the labor and who was doing all this work?
Yeah, when we think about animation, we should always be thinking about labor. We think about a movie set in general, and like there's so many people involved. It's easy to say like, oh, there's the set designer, you know, there's the cinematographer, there's the best boy and the gaffer. But there's just as many people working in an animated film. It's just that their labor is invisible because we don't end up really seeing them on screen, and we only see the eventual art that results from their work. Early on in animation, early animated films, they're primarily made by one person, right? Like one artist does everything from the writing to the designing to the drawing, everything. But that's really inefficient. That takes a lot of time. It's super, super labor intensive. So once animation becomes something that's picked up by bigger studios, the studios start thinking, well, we could actually make this a much more efficient practice. So in the 1910s, cell animation is developed, and that's where you have the cell of the character animation on top of an already animated background environment, so you don't have to redo that background every time. But the other thing that's determined by studios, as well as people like Winsor McCay, who are working on animation and creating these great innovations at this time, they realize that what we can do is we can do something called in-betweening using keyframes. And a keyframe is going to be like the major movements of a character. So think of a character like jumping in the air and landing. The keyframes could be the character preparing to jump, the top of the jump, and then the bottom of the jump. But in between, there's a whole array of like very minuscule, tiny movements that the character is making. So you can have your head animator do those keyframes, right? And establish those big movements that require a lot more expertise and a lot more artistry. And then you can have other folks come in and do the what is called the in-betweening. And those were positions, the in-betweeners or the colorists or like the line colorists. Those are positions usually taken on by people who might be apprentices, who might be learning the trade. and actually often by women. So these are really, you know, really important roles, but they're performed by people who are generally like below the line folks. As we move forward in the history of animation, that kind of labor becomes a real sticking point, right? How do people get paid for the work that they're doing, the really important work that they're doing? That's why in 1941, we see the Walt Disney Animation Strike, which was a really big thing that rocked the industry and important to think about today when we're actually going through the SAG-AFTRA strike as well.
Looking at the history of animation with Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies from UW-Milwaukee, let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Chris is with us in Delavan. Chris, hi.
Hi, how's it going? I just wanted to make a comment that you know, the animation style that Across the Spider-Verse did and its predecessor, I thought was really positive to the industry. And that's one of the main reasons why people really love it. And, you know, especially since, you know, anime is becoming so popular and mainstream nowadays. And what's really funny, you know, because we brought up Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and how this next movie that's coming out is going to be kind of following that same animation style. I was talking to my fiance the other week and I said, wouldn't it be great if Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles would do something like this? Because I feel like that's what they need, because all this realistic, you know, animation that they've been doing the last, you know, 20 years, I don't think works for them. It's a little creepy. And I just think that would be great. And then lo and behold, I saw an article and that's, sure enough, that's what they're doing. And
Chris, I think it's wonderful. Thanks a lot for the call, Chris. And Jocelyn, Chris gives us a lot there. We've had this Disney Pixar, well, Pixar then bought by Disney style, the 3D animation, and these reactions to it now with the Spider-Man movie, the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie on the way.
Totally. I mean, I think like the obsession with this particular version of digital realism is so annoying. It's so reductive, right? It doesn't leave space for some of the wonderful things that animation can do. Animation is a mode of like boundless possibility, right? It's the space where absolutely anything can happen. And I think we've gotten really stuck in this mode of mimicking reality as opposed to embracing the wonderful stylization, the wonderful artistry, all these like absolutely incredible possibilities that have always been latent in animation. So if you watch something like Fleischer Brothers cartoons from the early 1930s, the Fleischer Brothers are some of my favorite animators, just like really amazing. If you watch them now, they will seem like completely bizarre, completely weird, because it was a moment of total experimentation. So I think with this obsession with being really, in some ways, you know, quote unquote, true to real life, we've forgotten about all of the boundless possibilities that animation actually grants us. So I agree. I'm just really excited to see a new level of artistry brought back into animation.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies, Associate Professor and Director of Film Studies at UW-Milwaukee, looking at animation and how it's changed over more than a century now. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite animated movie or TV show? How have you seen animation change over maybe your lifestyle? Is there a favorite style, a favorite producer, director of animation? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies, Associate Professor and Director of Film Studies at UW-Milwaukee. We're looking at the history of animation from the dawn of moving pictures through the Spider-Man multiverse and beyond. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have an all-time favorite animated TV show or movie? What do you see as really groundbreaking? Do you have a favorite style, old school or newfangled? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Back to your calls. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, you got a favorite?
I do, yeah. Thanks, Rob. Ever since I was a kid, I've always liked Donald Duck. And the reason is he has emotions. And when I was a kid, I always watched him express his emotions. And he always came to a point of laughter. So years later, I was on a cruise and I bought a lithograph of Donald Duck laughing. And in my apartment, I put the lithograph as the last thing I would see when I left my apartment. And he always made my day, because his laughter and his smile, I mean, the emotions were real to me and pointed the right direction of how I wanted to feel. And it was more than just entertainment to me. It was really kind of a psychological affection I had for him.
Interesting, Jeff. Thanks a lot for that. And Jocelyn, Jeff points toward the connection we could feel with these clearly non-real characters from, you know, a Donald Duck through maybe a Pixar character or beyond.
Absolutely. And, you know, Jeff is like actually absolutely right. He has this feeling, but what he's also noticing is something that was deliberately put in there by Disney. Disney animators were trained in the 1930s in a form of animating action that is extremely expressive. So they were actually trained by folks who came from the acting world as to how to integrate movements that specifically spoke to emotional expression. That was something that Disney animators deliberately developed over time, and it was particularly studied right when Snow White was being made. And Snow White's also made with the use of the rotoscope, a really important animation technology where an actor is shot live action, and then the animator traces on top of that actor. So that translates to a real fluidity of movement. It actually is kind of like an uncanny movement a little bit, but it's very fluid, very naturalistic. And then the animators would later use that footage to study movement and then to integrate that kind of expressive movement into characters, specifically to create an emotional connection with the audience.
Thanks a lot for the call, Jeff. I want to back up. We talked about kind of the post-Pixar era. I want to talk about the movie that kicked off Pixar being the thing.
You're my favorite deputy.
You got a friend in me.
And here, Jocelyn, a lot of people had a friend in Buzz Lightyear and the others in Toy Story. Now we're so used to the style. How big a deal was it when Toy Story came out?
It was such a huge deal. Sorry, there's
an air show going on behind you, I understand. Yeah.
Yeah, the air show is happening back there. It was such a massive deal. So Toy Story comes out in 95, and there's already a lot of experimentation with digital animation at that point, but Toy Story is the first fully digitally animated feature. So it was just like a massive deal. If we look back at it now, it's actually kind of creepy. Like, the characters don't blink. It's very creepy if you look at it now. But it really was massively groundbreaking. And Pixar itself has just been such a juggernaut in terms of animation. Once Disney finally acquires Pixar in 2006, well, they had tried to do it for quite a long time, but they finally do acquire them in 2006. And that really leads to Disney being like such a massive global multimedia conglomerate that really directs how we understand childhood to a great extent.
Let's go back to our callers. Jack is with us now in Madison. Jack, hi.
Hi, Rob. Hey, so I heard your guest talking about Toy Story just a moment ago, and I said that I was born the year it came out, incidentally, so I've always had a thing for CGI, but I guess to combine that with, you know, talk about Snow White and the other old animated pics got me thinking about a game that came out a couple years ago called Cuphead. Mm-hmm. You might have heard of it, and I think it's really cool the way those game devs were able to fuse a lot of the digital and CGI tech that we have today with nostalgia for old animation. And I know, just it's cool thinking about how and when the older mediums meet the newer ones and what implications those have for future games and movies.
Jack, a great point. And not just Cuphead, but I think a lot of video games play with different animation styles. And I've read, at least, Jocelyn, that the Spider-Verse movies are then looking to video games as inspiration as well. There's this conversation going on.
Oh my gosh, you can't see me clapping, but I am like so excited that Cuphead was brought up. Let me be frank, Rob. I can't play video games like Mario jumps, he falls in the hole. Mario jumps, that's my video games experience. But I have a special love in my heart for Cuphead because it's based on Max and Dave Fleischer's cartoons from the early 1930s. They were famous for a style that we call rubber animation. And that's where, you know, you'll see in Cuphead that like the characters kind of like stretch and shrink and they bounce off things. And they have this very kind of like bouncy, springy kind of a way to them. That is directly inspired by the Fleischers. And the Fleischers worked a lot with urban life. They were New York animators. They were Jewish. They were around a lot of immigrant communities. They went to the Cotton Club and they loved Cab Calloway. So there was a lot about like the urban multi-ethnic depression experience in their films. And then we see that in Cuphead now, it looks so uncanny to us because it's actually from an earlier moment in history. And history is something that gets very deeply uncanny for all of us. But video games in general, so important for animation. I think about something like Final Fantasy from 2001, which was a massive box office failure, but was actually directed by the creator of the game. So that's like an early moment where we see this transition from video games into animated feature and vice versa. They're kind of always playing into each other in multiple ways.
Jack, thanks a lot for the call. Jocelyn, I don't want to get out of this conversation about animation without a visit to Japan. Anime, the catch-all term for a huge variety of animation coming out of Japan. What are some of the distinctive styles we see in animation from Japan?
Yeah, there's so many that to point to, but I think we think a lot about something like Astro Boy, right? Like from the 1960s, which actually, it's really, really funny, is based in part on the Walt Disney style. So that's actually based on something like Bambi, the really big eyes. So a lot of like what we think of as originating from Japanese animation also is inspired by cultural product from the United States. So those really big eyes, especially from these earlier moments of Japanese animation, are in large part inspired by Disney characters. One of the things that's really important for Japanese animation too is the usage of limited animation. And, you know, I should try to like keep this as short as possible, but limited animation is essentially animating fewer than 12 frames per second. And that gives it that kind of stilled quality, right? Like where a character might be screaming and they're frozen. That's very, very much a hallmark of Japanese animation. But also just really elaborate environments, right? Like really fast movement, fast kind of camera movement as opposed to character movement. Japanese animation is a really, really rich, incredible legacy of powerful artistry and really, really big ideas.
And briefly, as we wrap up, Jocelyn, is there something you are excited about on the horizons of animation?
Well, my favorite contemporary story is, or contemporary studio, pardon me, is Laika Studios, who are responsible for Coraline, for Paranorman, for Kubo and the Two Strings. I'm looking forward to their newest film because they integrate wonderful artistry, beautiful stop motion animation that's very detailed and very stylized with some usage of digital smoothing. So you still have that wonderful feel of the hand of the artist that's combined with the forefront of digital technologies. And I love that they use so many human beings to make what they make. Right now, especially, it's so essential for us to remember that art is created by human beings and not by machines.
Jocelyn, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
It's so wonderful to be on. It's great to talk to you, Rob.
That's Jocelyn Slepaniak-Gillies, Associate Professor and Director of Film Studies at UW-Milwaukee. She talked to us about the history of animation and how the techniques of the past influence the animated movies and TV shows of today. Hey, there is still time for you to share your favorite animated movies and TV shows, or maybe a character from the world of animation from anywhere in the world. Tell us about it over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. If I get a couple few responses on that, I'll share them maybe tomorrow or next week.